I use an iPad for pretty much everything from editing and recording this podcast to staying on top of news and current trends. The one app that I use actually that's helpful for me at least is Flipboard. Flipboard curates the world's stories so you can be smarter in your work, life, and play. You can choose from thousands of topics to personalize your Flipboard and get the latest stories from the best publishers and experts delivered to you 24/7. Now, when you see these stories, you can just tap the plus button to add them to a private or public collection, and it's very simple. And you can get started now at flipboard.com. When we met at Lightfoot, right, the Lightfoot Market, when I was doing Snooze of Coffee, your booth like stood out from the rest, you know. And I say that with the utmost endearment in terms of the placement, like the product placement and your custom table. Like I can see that you had the eye, the aesthetics going, and I knew that you cared enough to put that much effort into a show table. But I was really curious about learning more about you and your origin story, because when I had emailed you to set this up, you told me that your dad was in hotels, which I think is a very interesting kind of segue into.
Well, both my parents were, and I'd say my mother probably foremost. They are basically, they were both fat cats in the Upper East Side of New York, and right around the time I was born in the mid 80s, they took a trip to Europe, and they saw this ad in the paper for it's not exactly a castle, but it's sort of this big 18th century property in northern France, which they thought as a joke, like we could kind of go visit that. And the context was, at the time, the French franc, which preceded the euro, hit a crisis, and basically, long story short, the dollar was super strong in France. So if you were American and went to France, it felt like you were super wealthy. You could buy everything seemed super right. cheap. So there, this sort of quasi-castle was cheaper than a small apartment in New York City.
Wow, at the time.
At the time. So they jokingly said, well, we could go over and move from New York and live in a castle in France, basically. So they went back home, and then, you know, that was, they weren't taking it seriously, but they visited and they thought it was amazing and, you know, whatever. When they got home, sort of a few weeks later, they'd been in New York for close to 15 years. So mm-hmm. They sort of felt ready to leave. And they started thinking back about that property in France and how they could sell their apartment, buy that there, have a bit of cash to spare.
And live in this castle.
But then, you know, you need to figure something out. It's expensive to maintain that kind of property, and, you know, they didn't have, you know, that much other wealth accumulated. So they came up with this idea of turning it into a bed and breakfast.
Right.
Kind of boutique hotel. And long story short, they did it. And they went into a country where they didn't speak the language, had mm-hmm. no idea about the culture, in going into an industry that they
didn't know anything about.
Had zero experience yeah. with. So they had a lot of tough lessons.
Along the way,
made
yeah.
a lot of mistakes. But eventually, you know, it was a fruitful experience. And the hotel became quite successful. And they, I think they look back on it as the most significant experience of their life, I think, certainly. And I think they have a sense that it sort of bought them a soul in a way.
Yeah.
I don't think they, especially in their careers, I don't think they felt a huge sense of pride in what they'd done before. And I think the hotel sort of changed everything. Mm. And it was a pretty, I grew up in that environment, and I was really privileged to be in so many ways where we were. To give you an idea of the setting, we were in a part of France that's not very touristy, or what wasn't at the time, still isn't. That's, I guess, sort of like the...
Is it like more countryside?
Yeah, it's sort of, I don't want to say the West Virginia of France, but it's it's very rural. It's yeah. sort of post-industrial. There used to be a lot of coal mining there, which no longer is active. So it's high unemployment. It's somewhat depressed, but also has a bit of Northern European energy. So culturally, it has a bit of some Northern European influences,
yeah.
sort of. The stereotype is that they're humble, hardworking
right.
people, and pretty and welcoming, actually. Of at the time, we were pretty much the only foreigners, you know,
right.
miles around. And yeah, it was a pretty just magical experience being part of that hotel. It was a beautiful property. Being in France, there's so much nature. We were in a village with 38 inhabitants now.
Really?
Now 36. There were more sheep in the village than people.
That's crazy.
So yeah, growing in a very rural, quite agricultural environment actually, but with this property where you know I learned so much from my parents that you know transcended hospitality in the narrow sense of you know, hotels and.
So you're pretty much born and raised in this hotel in France. Like growing up, that was your childhood.
Yeah, yeah, you learn a lot that way in a more innate subconscious sense where as you know a young as a 4 year old you learn to not shout or drop your toys in you know the guest spaces. It teaches you some kind of discipline and diplomacy also. And then the thing that was really particular to my parents that I and one of the things I really respect them for was the attention to detail around creating a certain experience, and for them it was rooted in showcasing the heritage and history of this place, and as a guest making it feel like you're living in a 300-year-old building and sort of sharing in the authenticity of that space, whether it's through the food that you're served or the furniture in your bedroom or even how staff interacts with you, and, you know, every touch point they thought about it. And that's definitely had a really big impact on me and made me certainly OCD to some extent. But yeah, that was something that stuck with me and I think really informs how I work today.
Right. So I'm assuming at this point, hotels was not really in your mind in terms of like the career that you wanted to pursue, perhaps?
No, I would say overall, no. I was actually, at that point, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I had three rough interests. One was some kind of international diplomacy or humanitarian involvement, sort of saving the world in some way, but very vaguely. I didn't really know how that would manifest. Another was a film or documentary filmmaking or journalism, somewhere around that.
Yeah.
And then a third was more around entrepreneurship, actually.
Yeah.
So those were sort of the three areas I knew I was the most interested. And I think the entrepreneurship part definitely comes from my parents, you know, me growing up with seeing them being like really real entrepreneurs. And my mother is a stereotypical entrepreneur that she can see sort of signs of defeat everywhere and she'll just bulldoze through and somehow she'll turn it around, which I wish I were completely like her, which I'm not.
but you just listed those three things, and I think they kind of cross over to what you're doing currently with this company that you have now, which you definitely do have humanitarian efforts and, you know, in what you do in sharing the profits. We'll, I would love to kind of talk more about that as well. But so then from this, from growing up in the countryside, more or less in France, in this hotel, and then moving to Italy, you know, and then appreciating what your parents had done and kind of having this awakening, I would say, about culture. How did this all translate into what you're doing now? And how did you come about founding, you know, Keep Candles?
Okay, I'm trying to think how to best tie this together because it does in many ways come back to what I'm doing now. I think on the candle specifically, I have to say that I have been a candle fanatic for quite some time before starting this company. And when I'm asked why I am, I can point out to why I think candles are great and they're great as an ambiance. They have so many sort of utilitarian functions and there's something sort of poetic and romantic that goes, you know, way beyond the utilitarian function. But I think what the hotel experience is ultimately what led me to appreciate those things about candles, where scent is one of those, all those things you're thinking about, or my parents were thinking about as hoteliers, when you step into a room and you're trying to create a certain experience, you think about the furniture, the visual look of things, you know, that things look historic but not run down, that it's respecting the tradition of the place. And smell is that unconscious thing that when you smell the cedar wood of the furniture or the wood polish on the ground, and it gives you a certain, when that gives you a certain feeling, and if that's replaced by, say, some sort of stale food lying around and that's what you're smelling, you know, your experience is radically different. And I think they were conscious about it. They didn't talk about it that much, but I definitely felt in, you know, the countryside in France and with the environment that was, there were a lot of interesting smells. I always liked smelling stuff, and yeah. I didn't really start theorizing, being interested in the theory of it until, you know, 8 years ago. But it's definitely that idea of using scent to help create an experience and help, you know, create a mood and an atmosphere. That's been something that I've personally been involved with in my own, you know, my own apartment, and always. Yeah, that's kind of on the candle side how I think I was influenced.
Yeah, and the opportunity to create, like, what was there, like a singular event? I was like, you know what, I wanna do this. I wanna start this company. Is what kind of ticked in your head and made you start Keep Candles?
It was two big things that came together at around the same time, where my current business partner Steve. Who I met in my previous job, we'd been roommates together. We'd worked very closely together. So coming back to your story about founders, we felt like we had a really deep level of trust in that we trusted each other to start something together, and we had the appetite to do that. And having been roommates, we'd found that we both shared this nerdiness around candles, and we would just talk about candles all the time. So it was kind of. Some people talk about sneakers. Some people
talk about sneakerheads. You guys are candleheads.
And yeah, we were candleheads, and we were kind of I'd been sort of embarrassed about it, until that point, and it was sort of liberating to find someone that I could talk with about. Some people talk about like sports scores, and we talk about the candle. it's sort of materialistic, but it was just a sort of our little nerdy thing, I guess. And then as we were talking about starting some things, we had this. Philosophical point of view around the kind of company we wanted to work for, and therefore the kind of company we wanted to create. And we had this idea around the word regenerative, which comes from agriculture, which is the idea that it's not enough to just limit, you know, the negative impact you make on the soil through, say, reducing pesticides, but actually need to live in harmony with the cycles of the soil and help actually regenerate the soil by practices that don't just stabilize the condition but make it better. And you can sort of apply that idea overall to climate change and to the political, social, and economic change we need to make as a society to confront climate change. And so we thought about, like, we're not made for politics, but we do know something about business, and maybe. If we could find an area that really excites us where we could apply that philosophy. And candles was just, it was there. We just talked about candles all the time. So we started nerding out about, we went from nerding out about scent, about candles as a product, to thinking about how we could make a business that was sustainable economically on one hand, and on the other hand, what would this 21st century model look like for a company selling stuff and in some ways engaging in consumerism, but at the same time changing the system around how we produce and consume the things we use every day.
Yeah. And then the name, does that come from Keep Street in Brooklyn?
We were roommates on Keep Street for 1 year. So that, given that was where we went from being acquaintances to being really good friends, and where we discovered our
shared this closet passion for candles.
Exactly, that it seemed like a fitting homage.
Yeah, and so how do you? Okay, so I think appreciating and loving something is one thing, but how do you go from that into actually making the product? So how did you YouTube it? Did you Google how to make candles? Or
yeah, great question. We made a lot of mistakes. Basically what you just said. We started by finding what was available to us by Googling and trial and error at home, and that made us learn some things. And then we then visited contract manufacturers and saw how they did things and asked them questions. And we were genuinely interested in working with a partner manufacturer at the beginning, and then we realized that it just wasn't going to work for how we wanted to create the product and operate the company. But through it, we learned, the main thing we learned was that it was doable to do it ourselves. And then we sort of figured out step by step with mistakes, seeking out a lot of advice, and trial and error. And I mean, that those were actually quite, on one hand, very fun times, those were early days, but also quite stressful because we weren't making any money, and we didn't, it was a bit scary. And so we had a lot of time pressure, but we figured it out somehow. Yeah.
During that time, were there any other candle companies that were doing that, A? And then B, were there any mentors that you were seeking out that helped you along the way too, or?
There were definitely a few other artisanal, I mean, yeah, I don't know if artisanal is actually the main way I describe us, but there were some artisanal, there were a couple artisanal brands in Brooklyn that were fairly successful already, that were doing cool stuff. Very different to us also, but brands that we respected. The candle community is funny, actually. There is a candle maker community where it's generally a good vibe, even though it's very competitive and there's so many brands. There's a fairly collaborative vibe overall.
Got it.
So there's a few other, especially contract manufacturers, who we're not really competing with for business because we're a direct brand and we're not trying to private label for other people. So we're fundamentally not competitors. So we have a few friends there who've been, you know, mentors and helpful. But at the end of the day, the process of candle making, it's a bit, bakers are going to get upset at me for making this analogy, I'm sure, but it's a bit like baking in that it's fairly easy to make a pastry. It's very hard to make a really good pastry, and I think that's true to candle making, where the fundamental process is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. But the reaching a really high level of quality is mostly a lot of trial and error, and it's mm-hmm. it's experience and time. So we figured we could, it was possible, and we just had to figure out and be smart in how we learn those lessons fast.
Yeah.
And try and also get influenced by people who understood manufacturing in slightly different or adjacent categories, whether it's soap, fragrance, or even industrial things that have nothing to do with candles, where they're just some methods that kind of apply across any product you make when you're trying to make something high quality.
So during this process where you were passionate about candles, and I'm assuming that you had tons of different candles from different candle makers in your Brooklyn apartment, what about your candle did you want to make sure was different from what you liked?
Yeah, there were two big ideas. One was, we'd reached this point as consumers where we found that there were, you could buy very cheap candles and you could go kind of all the way up to $20, $30. And the quality sort of gets better. But then there's a big price gap between 30 and 60, and sort of 60 to 90, there's essentially the candles made where the scents are made by master perfumers as opposed to being stock fragrances, and you can really tell the difference. And we really could tell the difference, but we paying $60 for a candle each time was sort of ridiculous, or something that we hoped people would buy for us, but we could never justify, you know, spending on ourselves. And so that was one thing where we wondered why it was so expensive. And now I kind of understand reluctantly, but there were also some ways to be smart and actually, you know, make it a little bit more, a little make the price a little bit less steep. And then the other thing was that those brands that whose scents we respected, none of them really spoke to us on a values or mission level. I mean, there's a really famous one with a French name right now that's, you know, $65, where it's owned by a London private equity fund, and I know that through my work. I'm sort of privy to that information, and I'm not really that excited about giving my money to that company. It's just not, it doesn't really represent me, and there's no mention about sustainability. It's not even that there's the mention. I know it's just not on their radar. And generally, all those brands that were selling those high quality scents, regardless of the price, or despite the high price, they weren't really putting any attention into sustainability in the broader sense. So our idea was we kind of wanted to make the candle that we wanted to buy, which was something that had that quality or that artistry of the master perfumer, as opposed to being essentially, you know, taken off the shelf as stock fragrances with, you know, a lower budget to buy nice ingredients on one hand, and then on the other hand, to be a bit more forward-looking in terms of how we, the process for making the candles, where we source our ingredients from, et cetera. So that was where we started, where we're like, there's no product that really speaks to us. And then there was the sort of final piece, which was just the delivery, where at the time there were no direct-to-consumer candles, and you know, we were of the generation that buys everything online. And none of these candles kind of all had this assumption that you couldn't sell candles online because there's this smell barrier, which is a real thing. But similarly, you know, shoes, glasses are all categories where people thought it was impossible to sell them online, and now we know you can.
That's true.
So we had this idea that actually we're not the first company to come up with the idea that you can cut out middlemen through being direct to consumer, you know, yeah. Everlane, Warby Parker, et cetera, do this.
Yeah.
Where we could help bring that price down. And so it's by no means a cheap product, but it's a product that is of the highest quality and slightly more attainable.
Yeah. Concept ideas here in terms of sustainability. I would love to talk about like the product itself, because I think I was on the website the other day and I saw multiple uses for the actual candle glass, mm-hmm. if you will, after you had used the wax. You could use it as a whiskey glass, which I thought was the number one thing in my head.
Yeah.
The second thing I saw was for flowers, like a vase, which is awesome. So I would love to hear more of your thought on the design process of the actual product itself, and maybe why, you know, why coconut candle wax is better than other waxes that are being used.
Oh, so many fun topics. So let me start with the glass. Our driving idea behind this regenerative business, let's call it, is this idea of reaching a point of net benefit in the future, which is sounds like an impossible goal, but I think with the technology and knowledge we have today, it's possible to be a net benefit company, meaning that your negative impact through all the things that you do, using energy, having a carbon footprint, et cetera, it's possible to not just reduce those, but sort of invert them and have a positive impact. We're not there yet, but that's what we're working towards. And with when we ship things, we've been trying to get as close as possible to zero waste. And our candles are mainly via subscription. And when people receive their candle, the whole packaging currently is compostable. So there's some Cargit that's compostable, and then there's a plant-based foam that's made from the roots of mushrooms, actually.
Really?
From a really cool company in upstate New York called Ecovative. And that you can compost it, put it in your plants in your garden, and it's plant food, basically. So the whole thing can go in the compost, and you're just left with the candle. And then the candle label itself is also compostable if you have composting. It's non-adhesive, meaning you can peel it off without leaving, you know, having to deal with annoying residue that you have to scratch off under the sink for 10 minutes. And then we use beeswax instead of glue to affix the wicks to the bottom of the glass, which, for one, beeswax is just a great material that's natural. And then second, it makes it easier to break it out, basically. So also when you're cleaning out your glass, right. And we give instructions on our website, it's just much easier. And the coconut wax itself, is being softer, is a bit easier to clean
out.
That's awesome. So then you can easily reuse it as, we actually designed the glasses to be primarily drinking glasses, because that was something we felt you could use multiple of pretty easily. But our customers are really creative and find all sorts of other uses, which we definitely encourage and are inspired by. And then finally, we've reached the point where we now have subscribers who've been subscribed for, you know, 2 years or more, where, you know, maybe after 24 glasses of these glasses, you don't have any more shelf space and you don't really need anymore, which we recognize.
They send it back to you, or?
So yeah, we have a program where people can send back the glass. Basically, when their next shipment comes, they just pop the glass back in the box and we send a shipping label, and then they just ship it back to us.
Wow.
And yeah, we'll clean it out and reuse it, basically.
That's amazing.
So we're not 100% circular, but we're getting closer and closer, which we're really excited by. And so trying to keep pioneering more on doing...
That's fantastic.
Trying to minimize our waste footprint and also our carbon footprint later.
Yeah. Is that kind of your continuous goal for the brand, is to find innovative ways to kind of maintain your company ethos of being sustainable, but continue to innovate your product in that way? Is that kind of like...
Yeah, it's definitely one of the pillars of our public benefit charter. So we basically have as a public benefit corporation, we have a duty to our shareholders and the rest of our stakeholders to, you know, be a profitable business, or else we die. But we also have a public benefit mission, which we've broken down into a few pillars, and one of those is innovating and pioneering on solutions that others might then adopt for different products. So things like how we work with packaging, processes for how we operate and create the product, how we ship, et cetera, et cetera. So that's definitely something that over the future of the company, we're going to keep working on.
That's awesome. How do you go about, the big question I had too, was you have all these scents, right? How do you come up and decide on these scents that you release?
So the scents, the reason they're so good is really because we have a master perfumer that we work with called Christophe Le Damiel. He is a sort of a perfumer's perfumer. He's really well regarded within the very small community of master perfumers. There's roughly 200 in the world. That it's not an official, like, you don't get a diploma master perfumer.
It's not like a master sommelier or anything, but there's...
Not exactly, but it's basically you need to go to school for perfumery, and then it's sort of 20 years of apprenticeship. And,
wow.
Even though there's no official title, if you call yourself a master perfumer when you're not accepted as one, the rest of the community will know that you're not.
Spanish,
it is. Yeah, so there's roughly like 200, so it's a really small crew who are basically artists, or the sort of equivalent of chefs in some way. But they also have to have a bit of chemistry knowledge and botany knowledge. And so they tend to be really interesting characters who kind of span multiple disciplines. And Christophe is not the only one, but he's one of a few who happens to have a very deep knowledge of chemistry. He taught chemistry at MIT for a while. So he can really switch from being a sort of crazy artist to mad scientist, or from one minute to the next, which is really fascinating. And you know, chemistry is around us everywhere, and so he has this really interesting view on the world that's both poetic and scientific, which we really enjoy. And so what we do is we've studied perfumery, Steve and I, but we're not master perfumers. So we typically come to him with a brief that essentially captures a concept, and you know, I might have a mood board.
I was going to say it's probably like a mood board type of thing.
Yeah, a mood board, a story, and then we'll also include some, our sense of what might be some scent notes or individual notes that might fit in it. And then typically we go with generally more than one concept at a time, and we sort of see what excites Christophe, and we basically don't allow ourselves to work with him on something that's not really exciting for him. And I think that's part of why he accepts to work with us at our small scale, is that we really value his talent as an artist. And so if he's working on something that he doesn't really believe in, then it's just probably not going to be as good.
Yeah.
So yeah, we get to a point where he's excited by a concept, and then we typically start by smelling a ton of stuff together, and sort of it helps us fine tune the first concept and say, like, this kind of smell is not going to be in there. This kind of smell fits. This kind of smell might be this facet of the scent. And then he'll start sending us samples or showing us samples. And we'll at some point typically do a second smelling session to kind of fine tune it all together. And then he'll continue sending samples. And every time we'll give feedback.
Wow.
It's a very long,
it's like a huge feedback loop.
Yeah, it takes
from
roughly
start to finish.
A year,
wow.
The development process for us. Some of them have been a bit quicker, but yeah, definitely Wood Cabin, which is one of our...
One of your signature scents, I would say, right?
Yeah, it's definitely one of our most popular ones. Took us a year. It was crazy. And so we had on that one, it's not the one that had the most, but it had, I think, 54 iterations for 54 mods.
Wow.
So it took us a really long time. I think our record is 70-something.
No way.
So yeah, it takes some of them. One of them we got our sort of record is doing it in 12, where we really quickly got to what we had in mind. But it's just really hard because we haven't grown up. None of us have grown up with the vocabulary of scent. You know, mm-hmm. in school, you're not taught that. Mm-hmm. At home, you know, very few families, you know, teach their children. In some cases, you know, about wine or about gastronomy, but it's rare to be taught about the nuances of smell. So we just don't have the vocabulary. And it's actually, you know, if you need to describe different facets of a smell, like the plant that's behind you, it's really, really hard. And even, and that's where perfumers are really, one of the things that they bring is that they're really able to dissect with their nose just through pure practice and experience the different elements that you're smelling. And it, you know, when they describe it to you, you're like, yeah, it really makes sense. Yeah. And now I see it. So yeah, that's kind of how we go about, that's the sort of quick overview of the process.
So for people at home that are listening right now, how can they find you online, Instagram? What's the best way to keep up with Keep Candles?
Cool. So first of all, it's Keep, K-E-A-P. You can Google us on the interwebs. The website's actually keepbk, as in Brooklyn.com. Our Instagram is @keepbk. Yeah, our main product, like I said, is through a candle subscription. That's also a way we can make it more affordable.
Yeah.
Because we don't, the reality is just we don't have to spend tons of money on marketing to get people, so we can kind of give that back as
You can choose your tiers, right? There's one candle a month, two candles a month, one candle every 2 months.
Yeah, and in fact it's a really light commitment because as long as you do more than one, you can do whatever, you can skip for 3 years if you want.
Yeah.
But it just locks in the subscriber price and you get a lot of perks. And we try and tell a story every month around that scent. So if we have a seasonal scent offering where it's sort of like the chef's choice, and we pick something that fits with the season. And we include some art and some stories around that scent to kind of sort of help you get away from the day-to-day and really dive into the scent, which is really fun. So, yeah, check it out.
All right, great. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Arnold. That was fun.
Appreciate it.